This is tape two, side one, Lawrence Henderson interview, August 30th, 1989.
As far as written reports were concerned, as I understand the procedure as it was, and I don't know whether it's that way now, a report would be written by an analyst or by a group of analysts who'd worked on a project. It would then be reviewed by the department head of the principal analyst or by other people who had contributed to the thing. Whether it got much of a review beyond that in Santa Monica has never been quite clear to me. In theory, there was some sort of a superior review. And then, in theory, it was supposed to come to us in Washington so we could look at it and see if we saw something in it that either didn't make sense or we didn't think was suitable for Rand to report to the Air Force or what have you. There were all sorts of reasons why we might have objected. We never had any serious technical objections because we didn't have much of a technical capability. Occasionally we had a few people in the Rand Washington office who were really competent in the particular area, but usually not. And so we would look at it and says, it looks all right to us, it's fine. But we had been bitten a number of times by reports coming out that we had not reviewed in the Washington office where there were stupid mistakes or, just things that hadn't been caught by the people in Santa Monica. And we felt we had a different point of view, a different outlook on the relationship with the Air Force or with whoever the customer of the report was, and that we ought to be able to take a look at it. And we, for a long time, we insisted on this very strongly because there had been a number of cases where things had gotten screwed up.
Could you just give us an example or two of what, how things had gotten screwed up?
Well, not really. It's very hard for me to remember things like that. George Tanham could probably give you better examples. He was instrumental in this review process, and we insisted on it. Actually, as a generalization, I had always felt that it was important to make sure that a report was properly written so it could be understood by the client and not just by the guy who wrote it. And as a matter of fact, I used to often say that I spent 25 years at Rand teaching PhDs how to write something sensible so somebody could understand it. And curiously enough, my father spent years at Harvard doing the same thing with his post-PhD colleagues in the Fatigue Laboratory and other places and so on. So I wasn't consciously doing what I had seen him do, but it turned out it was very much the same thing. And I remember some of the very best people we had, like Alan Enthoven, for example. I used to say, for God's sake, don't get shot down for the wrong reasons. Don't write something that people are going to misunderstand or is going to antagonize them when you don't need to do it. When you've got something that's useful to say, say that. Don't say something else. Don't make it so confusing. Don't appeal to the prejudices of somebody on something that's of no significance to what you're trying to really say. And I spent 25 years really doing this kind of thing. It's not that I'm a great writer myself, but I think I can tell when a report is stands on its own feet and is correct and is understandable and straightforward, and one that is turgid and misleading
Would this mean literally sitting down and reading page by page reports?
Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. We read every damn one. Sure. How else can you do it? Oh, sure.
I guess I'm just wondering how you had time for anything else. I mean, that's a pretty big job.
Oh, well, there weren't all that many reports that were significant, or that were going to the Air Force, or that really related to policy. Some of them you could just look at casually, and you could tell they'd be all right.
Okay, so
we were not mathematicians. If it was a mathematics report, I mean, you know.
Okay, so you were focusing on ones that had clear policy implications.
That's right. That's okay. Right.
What else were you looking for besides clarity of expression?
Basically, that's all. We weren't really looking to to avoid controversy or anything of that sort. I mean, sure, there was controversy, but we weren't worried as long as the controversy was a real controversy and not a controversy about the way something had been written or the way it had been presented or who had gotten a copy and this that kind of thing. Controversy is fine. In fact, that was the whole lifeblood of RAND is controversy. Otherwise, it wouldn't be doing its job, would seem to me.
What consideration did you give about the effective presentation of these reports? I mean, there were issues of timing.
Oh, yeah, sure, issues of timing and briefing and whether whether the documentation is adequate and, sure. Oh, yeah. And, major briefings we would hope to review in the Washington office, too, before they went to the Air Force. That didn't always happen, but it usually did. Or we went out to Santa Monica and listened to the briefing or discussed the report with the people, what have you. We were involved in it because, for example, the kind of thing, we were very much interested in important work that we thought was important to the Air Force to make sure it got the right hearing. And, for example, I spent days wandering around with Albert Wohlstetter about the major studies he did on basing and on the alert and force structure and so on, and we would go from office to office in the air staff and discuss this with the relevant people, make sure that they understood what we were trying to say and not something else and so on.
Yeah, I'd be interested in if we can use the Wohlstetter case as an example.
Sure.
Of how you formulated a strategy to make sure that you got a hearing for a report like this that you thought was important for the Air Force.
Well, if you had something that you thought was important, the first thing you wanted to avoid, if you could, is the ramming down the working level's throat syndrome, if you see what I mean. In other words, you've got a report that if they do something about it is going to affect the work of people in a lot of different areas and at different levels. So the first thing to do is to try to make sure that the people at the lower levels understand what you're trying to do and why. They don't necessarily have to agree with you completely, but you ought to inform them so that they don't go around saying that you've done an end run and you're irresponsible and so on.
So that means getting to them early.
Yes,
absolutely. You don't want them to suddenly
find that the chief of staff has just made a decision, No. So you work with them and then you work your way up. And you may run into difficulties. You may run into offices that disagree violently with what you're doing. But as long as you've informed them properly, and then you can make use of the people who disagree with them but may agree with you. And you try to do this in as sensible a way as you possibly can, and you work your way up to the point, having started at the bottom, where Albert and I were writing memorandums for the signature of the chief of staff. But you can't do this unless you've done it responsibly all the way up the line.
With the aim being perhaps that there should be no big surprises when the final.
And you may have difficulties, particularly if you're dealing with let's say the strategic posture of the bomber force the commander in chief of SAC is going to feel that he's the guy who really ought to, who knows everything about it and is going to make all the right decisions and so on. You may find that eventually you end up with a major disagreement with him. But he'll fight you all the way. But if you've informed him properly at first, so he knows what the issue is, and then you operate responsibly, you can win the argument. But you've got to be sure you don't get shot down for being stupid or intolerant or irresponsible. This is the thing that is to prevent irresponsibility, mainly, that our review function in Washington was, or our knowledge of the air staff. To make sure that things are done in a professional way, but also from a policy point of view, that are done responsibly, from a political point of view. In other words, the last thing you want is some analyst going leaking stuff to Sam Nunn. You see what I mean?
Something like the Wallstetter study. The implications of that were enormous.
Sure.
That had come
as
a surprise to some,
sure,
to some people. It could have been disastrous.
Sure, absolutely.
So there must have been two aspects of that were tough for you. One is coordinating all of this bottom up,
sure,
informing,
sure,
people and,
sure,
and everything, and the other thing is escorting Wallstetter himself,
sure,
around, who,
sure,
at that time,
sure,
was not exactly somebody with a great deal of savvy about interacting with people in the Pentagon.
Well, I don't know. You know, Albert's a pretty remarkable guy. Sure, a lot of people disliked him. But it was obvious that he had complete command of the facts and of the study, and he knew what he was talking about. And even specialists at SAC would ask him questions, and he would know more than they did about what was really happening out on the line. Now, I mean, this is pretty impressive to any Air Force officer, even if he's antagonistic to your ideas. And in other words, Albert did such a thorough job that it was just very hard to trip him up. Now, there were a lot of other people at Rand who would occasionally get tripped up, not necessarily by their fault, but because it's very difficult to do this thing thoroughly. But Albert did all this very well, I think, with a guy who was as much of a maverick as Albert is, and as much of an intellectual and all that kind of business. He handled himself, I think, remarkably well in all of the circumstances.
Do you find yourself having to coach analysts on the local culture?
Oh, hell yes.
Dave, have a talk, how to act. Who's,
hell yes, sure.
Say, we're going to go see so-and-so, you have to watch out for this and that.
Sure, absolutely, sure. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, this was a large part of my function. Sure. I'm not suggesting that I got along with all of them perfectly either. I had friends and enemies in the air staff. I tried to stay away from the enemies as much as possible, or circumvent them, or handle it. But there was always what you might call a reservoir of imaginative officers who understood what we were trying to do and didn't necessarily think we were always right. But and in my experience, these are the guys that really run things. It's those people. It's not the the hidebound people. It's not the reactionary people. It's the more imaginative, friendly people. Well, let me give you a ridiculous example. It's not important, but it kind of exemplifies this. There was an officer who retired some years ago as a lieutenant general, who was a very sophisticated Air Force officer, and he had a fabulous sense of humor. And he was quite a rich man. He was a member of the Eagle Pitcher Lead family. His name was Oliver Pitcher, Ollie Pitcher, P-I-C-H-E-R. And he was in the planning phase of the Air Force. I never had much to do with him, with Rand, and Rand, he was kind of in the planning and programming part. Rand never had much to do with him, but he was a guy around, and he was such an obviously bright, imaginative, interesting guy that we got fairly friendly. And I was walking down. We put out a report at one point, which was pure mathematics, called A Million Random Digits with Normal, 1,000 Normal Deviates, or something. I forget the exact title. Anyway, this great big thick thing, which was very useful to Los Alamos in doing Monte Carlo calculations and things like that. You know, it was a useful piece of technical, had no interest to the air staff, of course, at all. Zilch. But copies were, of course, distributed around. So when I was walking down the corridor in the Pentagon one morning, and I ran into Ollie Pitcher coming in the other direction. And he stopped me and he said, "Larry, how's your random digit today?" You know, which to me indicated that A, he had a good sense of humor. B, he understood that this was an important report, although it was no interest whatever to him. And let's see, you know, he liked to keep friendly relations. And, you know, and when he retired, I went to his retirement ceremony at Andrews Air Force Base. And I said, "Ollie, I'm terribly sorry to see you go. What are you going to do?" He says, "I'm moving to Hawaii and grow martini trees." Wonderful guy. I won't bore you with the story. He created a sensation, a horrible sensation, at one of General MacArthur's staff meetings by pulling a practical joke, which, you know, kind of looking around, "Who, me?" You know, and it disrupted the whole meeting, and MacArthur got livid. He got absolutely livid. Well, it's a good story, but it has nothing to do with Red. This was a staff meeting, and MacArthur was always very stuffy about his staff meetings and that kind of thing. And there was a particularly stuffy Army general who was on the staff. And Ollie Pitcher was there at this meeting, and they were waiting for MacArthur, and he was talking to this Army general, and the Army general proudly showed him a new watch he had, which was an alarm watch. It was in the early days before there were many of them. And Ollie said, "Gee, that's fascinating. Let me take a look at it." So Ollie took a look at it, and he set the alarm for 10 minutes from that, or something like that, and left it on and gave it back to the Army general. The Army general was too stupid to notice what had happened, put it back on. And right in the middle of one of MacArthur's most important directives, you know, verbal directives, the alarm went off. And the general didn't know how to shut it off. You know, it went on and on. I always loved that. That was just marvelous. Yeah.
That's good.
This guy was irrepressible and just charming. That's a wonderful guy. You have these little experiences which make life worthwhile. Oh, boy. Now, don't get me off on all of these side shows. I don't know how to say more about the, you know, vetting the reports and trying to help the RAND analysts who came in, trying to be vulgar, sell the results to the customer and so on. It's mm-hmm. just, it's standard. Everybody does this to some degree. And I think in the case of RAND, it was a little more sophisticated than the usual situation of a contractor coming in and giving a briefing about that they ought to buy this piece of equipment, you know. Was a little more subtle than that, but it's basically the same kind
what,
of
what does the process say that you went through with Elbert in presenting his report say about the process of Air Force decision making? I mean, what was your perception of how decisions were made in the Air Force?
Well, my perception was that on important issues like that, a great deal of care went into the decision and a great deal of thought, and that eventually, if you could make a contribution which would make the decision easier or make it more obvious that the decision ought to go this way rather than that way, that you could win the argument if you did it right. I never had the feeling that at the air staff level or at the senior officers board level or even the JCS level that these decisions weren't made fairly well on the whole. I didn't have a feeling that it's... Now, at the JCS, when you get into these arguments about the Air Force versus the Army versus the Navy and who's going to scratch whose back and who's going to get this part of the budget, that's kind of a different area that I never was directly involved in. But in the meetings that I would go to, the meetings of the Air Force Council or even of the JCS, you had the feeling that this is a serious decision-making operation and pretty good. Pretty good. I haven't been to countless numbers of directors' meetings of corporations, so maybe I don't, but I've been to some of them. And I've been to, of course, all the RAND trustees' meetings and all the trustees' meetings of ANSWER and so on. And I've been to other meetings in Research and Development Board and that kind of thing. I have a feeling that these decisions that go on at the air staff level are pretty good on the whole, sensible. But the question is, do they have all the relevant facts at their disposal? Do they have, you know, do they have the right advice and so on? And this, you never know. You just hope that they do.
It must have been tempting for analysts, especially when dealing with a big decision issue.
Yeah.
It must have been tempting for them, having spent all the time thinking about it, amassing the data, and convincing themselves that there's a certain course of action that ought
yes.
to be followed.
Yeah, right.
It must have been tempting for them to try to sell that potential decision to the Air Force. Did you ever have analysts coming to you saying, look, they're just not listening to me?
Oh, heavens, yes, sure. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that was true. Sometimes it wasn't. Sometimes they had very good reasons for not listening. It wasn't all a bed of roses. And often you'd be very disappointed that you didn't, or the analyst would, or the rest of us would, very disappointed that we didn't get the idea across properly. And we'd go back and see what we could do to change that, or whether we were right or not, whether we'd included all the proper factors in the analysis. You'd have differences. You'd have analysts who were fed up because they didn't think they were getting a decent hearing.
Would they sometimes make end runs around you, appeal directly to...
Not usually around me. They would make end runs around people in the air staff that had a legitimate interest. In other words, they'd go to A instead of going to B because they knew they'd get a better response from A. Now, that's all right up to a point, but it's not useful if B really has the major interest in the subject.
Mm-hmm. They liked the idea that RAND was located in Santa Monica because you miss a lot of brush fires when you're in Santa Monica.
It seems to me
that one of your jobs was to be in the brush fire country to some extent.
Oh, to some extent, yes, right. But I didn't...
You must have had to do damage control for some of these things.
Oh, sure. Right. No, it was an interesting job, and you know, there were times when you felt you were spinning your wheels and other times when you thought you were making progress.
What you've described is basically a kind of the straightforward element of relaying RAND interests to the Air Force, presentation of the facts,
sure,
and that sort of thing.
Sure.
Did the board ever get involved and say, you know, pick up the phone and call somebody and say, you know, we agree this is an important study, you ought to give it your attention? Did you bring...
Board of Trustees never got involved in that at all. The only time that they would get in, that they ever got involved that I know of is when there was some criticism by the Air Force of something that RAND was doing or somebody at RAND or something like that, and then occasionally, this only happened like two or three times in the 25 years that I was involved.
But you felt once you made these series of presentation, taking care to address proper elements of the Air Force, that you'd done just about all you could do to make the RAND case.
Yeah, pretty much. Sure. Sure. Oh, no, nobody tried to put any pressure on them. Well, maybe some of them did, but I wasn't really aware. I never ran into a serious problem that way. There were minor end runs, but nothing really serious.
No, it wasn't the aim of pressure just so much as getting an audience. Yeah.
Yeah.
Would this be the same kind of process? I guess in Albert's case, we were talking about a report, and I think a formal recommendation went along with
yes,
that.
Yes, sure.
Would for formal recommendations, would they usually be handled in the same way, series of briefings, or was there some other mechanism?
Oh, no, pretty much, yes, sure. Well, you'd have to have a report to back up the recommendation. Something in writing that treated the subject adequately, you hoped. And briefings, yes. You're stuck with briefings because that's the way that these things are presented in the Pentagon. And we were never wedded to the idea of briefings, but you had to do them because they were part of the style, part of the way the country operated.
There's a certain mystique that surrounds the RAND briefing, and especially a notion that the dry runs and the briefings in Santa Monica were pretty rough and tumble, even to the point of, at some points, I'm trying to remember the dates on these, but it's in the 53, 54, I've seen some references in correspondence to people getting pretty worried that the art of the rough and tumble briefing in the Santa Monica is getting to be a favorite sport, and that there's a certain sense in which people are forgetting protocol and all of that. It seemed to get to be a hot issue for a while.
Well, it might have been. There were always a few mavericks at RAND who would like to go to listen to dry run briefings and try to shoot down the briefer just for the hell of it. Now, that the number of people that did that was relatively small. Fortunately, because what you needed was people who were serious about shooting down the briefer. Now, that was trying to really find out what the flaws were in the thing and help to correct them.
But did you play a role in helping to translate or help the briefings that were being done in Santa Monica and the dry runs and the evolving nature of what was going to be done in the briefing, get that into a form where it would get the best hearing in the Air Force, that is, conform to
to some degree, yes. We would, but not too much. We tried to let that be done in Santa Monica as much as we could, and sure, some of it was controversial, but Now, by the time a briefing would get to Washington, unless we happened, George or I or somebody had happened to be in Santa Monica at the time of the dry run, we didn't get directly involved in it. We assumed that by the time it had gone through the gauntlet in Santa Monica, that most of the flaws had been ironed out.
Would you attend most of them in the Pentagon if they're most of the briefings that were done? In the
yeah.
Pentagon,
oh yeah. Sure.
You would
oh sure.
There.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
For
sure.
What percentage of them would that be the first time you ever saw it?
Maybe 50%, as high as that.
You would have seen the written stuff.
I might have seen the written, yes, I'm not sure. I would have known about the project and so on, but I wouldn't necessarily have seen the briefing.
For particularly
some of it depended on the analysts. There'd be analysts from Santa Monica who would come in who would want us to look at the briefing before he took it to the Pentagon and asked our advice about what to do and what not to do. In other cases where they were doing it for a special section of the air staff and everybody knew what it was and so on. It depended on the subject and to some degree on the analyst. You know, some analysts were more or less satisfied with the briefing the way it was and didn't want anybody fiddling with it or changing it. But I can think of a good example of that, and that's Tom Jones, who was the chairman of Northrop now, who did a lot of very useful study on transport aircraft early on in RAND. And he was a very strong-minded, very competent aeronautical engineer and analyst. And I'm sure he didn't want anybody second-guessing his work, and that was right. He there was no need to, because he had that kind of competence and understanding and charisma and so on. That's why he became chairman of a big corporation. In other cases, people like Bert Klein would come in and say to me, "I want you to look at this, you know, because I want your ideas about how to do this and do that, and so on." A lot of it depended on the personality and on the type of job, type of the subject matter, and so on.
Well, I guess I just want to take a check here and see how you're doing in terms of time. And
I'm fine. I've got plenty of time at the moment.
Okay. Well, I think there's more questions to ask about the Air Force stuff, but I know you expressed an interest earlier about setting down what your philosophy of management of.
Well, I don't really. I don't think you're going to find this particularly interesting. As I say, I can do it very quickly. My philosophy of management basically is in this kind of an area. Let people alone. Don't try to regiment them. Don't set up a bunch of fancy organizations. Don't set up a bunch of charts. Don't try to make sure that A reports to B properly and B reports to C and so on. My general philosophy is embodied in this article in the book that you can get, Joe McCloskey's book on operations research. And I never bothered much with things that did bother some of the people in Santa Monica, including Albert Wolster's very good paper that you gave me a copy of, which is excellent. For example, you take Ed Lindblom's papers. He's waxes very philosophical about organization and management and so on and so forth, and a lot of what he says makes good sense, and he's obviously a highly intelligent guy and all that kind of business. But you start thinking about some of the recommendations that he makes. Some are tentative, of course, and some of the recommendations. I was struck by one recommendation which fascinated me. He said that RAND ought to consider setting up something like a faculty group, you know, a, a, like a faculty senate in the university. And my reaction to that was, that would be absolute murder in a place like Rand. It's just the wrong thing to do. It's bad enough to try to administer a university without having the faculty senate telling you how to do it. And I used to observe this. My father was active in the management of Harvard for a long time, informally and otherwise. And I've seen what has happened to other university presidents when they've been faced with this kind of thing, and generally in universities. And I have a feeling that Frank, I'm sure, shared this view. Don't try to set up a fancy hierarchy. Don't look at all the books on organization and management. Don't pay any attention to what the Harvard Business School teaches. I can say this with some feeling since I'm a graduate of the Harvard Business School myself. But if the way the thing is working works reasonably well, don't expect it to be perfect. There will always be conflicts. And particularly the conflict that we have at Rand that has been going on since the very beginning between A, who works for division chief number one, who is doing analytical work with B, who is the head of an interdivisional project. Now the question is A going to get short shrift on salary? Is he going to be mistreated by his division chief because the division chief is not sympathetic to the project? You know, and all of those kinds of controversies. That's going to go on no matter how you do it, no matter how you set it up. And probably the way we have it set up in Rand, more or less, is a reasonable way you have. In other words, you have divisions, you have technical divisions, and then you have work that's going on that goes crosswise to the technical divisions. Of course, now we have so many different departments and things at Rand that this is kind of beyond me, and I don't want to try to get involved in what the management should be like now because I don't know about it. But I'll bet you that if you ask the new president, Jim Thompson, who had a good, interesting experience of a variety of things, that he would say the same thing that I'm saying, essentially, that, you know, don't try to mess with messing with the organization isn't going to do any good. Now, you can do something about moving people back and forth and selecting people. Yes, that's very important. But as far as the organization is concerned, changing the organization chart saying that we ought to have a bunch of divisions in which each division is an interdisciplinary division and so on. Come on, just leave it alone. It's good for the mathematicians to be in a division which is headed by a mathematician, and good for the economists and so on. But that doesn't mean that they should always be working in that division. They should work across the board, and there should be some way of making sure that a person who is very good in an interdisciplinary team doesn't suffer in his discipline division from doing more work outside the division than within. But those are things you can handle on an individual basis. You can't really solve them on an organizational basis, I don't think. So I'm in other words, flexibility is what I would regard as being important. And lack of hierarchy. I think lack of hierarchy in a thing like Rand is just terribly important. Very important. Now, I don't know how they operate. The thing is now so complex. We have all this, we have this major health services research going on and so on. How you handle that. When we set up the New York City Rand Institute, we had another problem. But there, that was small enough in itself so that we could handle it the way Rand had originally been handled, pretty much. But with all this activity that's going on in Santa Monica, it's not clear to me how you manage that except by not managing it. In other words, mostly hands off. But that's
Did you get directly involved with these issues that I assume were of more moment out in Santa Monica than they were in Washington?
I didn't really get directly involved in them, no. I would observe them, observe the controversies going on and say to myself, well, you know, it's not my dish of tea. I don't want to get involved in it. Let Frank handle it or whoever was handling it. And I think on the whole, they handled it reasonably well. Never to the satisfaction of everybody, of course. But at least there wasn't a faculty senate where you could bring this up and get into a fight about it. it was the individuals involved, and that's fine.
Yeah. One.
And the individual, as long as the individuals have access to the management, obviously, it would be absolutely terrible if a guy who worked in a division didn't feel that he could go complain to the management about something. I mean, this is you know, that kind of hierarchy in an industrial company it makes me shudder. I mean, you know, in terms of the kinds of things I'm interested in, I want anybody to be able to come and see me if I'm the boss, period. And I want to make sure that he comes and sees me, and I want to make sure he doesn't get penalized for coming and seeing me because he's going over somebody's head. I mean, in a place like RAND, I think this is absolutely essential. Of course, you have to handle it right. In other words, your division chief is going to be mad at you, maybe, if you go see the boss anyway. But at least there are ways of handling it, and as long as he knows that the boss will not sit still for it if he does anything for being mad, that's... But this is, it's a great vague area in which I don't think there are very many experts, but that's just my personal view.
As someone who did have, you know, formal business school training, I mean,
sure,
did the notion of kind of a freewheeling organization sort of present it to yourself naturally, or were your initial instincts that there had to be more structure in this organization?
No, my initial instincts were as they are now. I don't know why. My experience in business was in the Chemical Bank and Trust Company, and banks are in theory notably rigid in their organizations. I never had that feeling in the bank. I started out as a trainee, and then I moved into the Latin American division, but I never had any qualms about going to see some vice president without without worrying about what my boss was going to think about it, if it was something that had to be done. And I never had any problems that way, but I didn't have a feeling that I was encased in a hierarchical organization that was preventing me from doing the kind of work I wanted to do, or the kind of work that I thought was good for the bank, or what have you. Now, I don't know why that's so. This may have been an unusual experience. It's true that I went from the credit department, which is a training operation, right into the foreign department, which is a kind of a maverick part of the bank, or was at the time, but a very successful and growing one, and full of people with different points of view and different problems and so on. But no, I don't think that what I learned at the business school, if I didn't move me in that direction at all, in the direction of thinking that there ought to be organizational charts and you know, and formal hierarchies and so forth. I don't...
Excuse me, we're doing an interview here.
I'm at the end of a side of a tape here.